I literally told myself, I was like, please, hands and feet still work. Like, I was worried in a way that I would forget upshifting, and I, like, my hands would just freeze. And I was just like, come on, like, I believed I could do it, but it was a weird feeling. I was like, I had a fear that maybe I would just completely disintegrate under the pressure of about to winning my first ever race.
Welcome to Beyond Victory. Thank you very much for tuning in. Please remember to subscribe if you're new to my podcast. In this episode, my guest is Daniel Ricciardo, one of the best Formula One drivers at the moment, so an ex-colleague of mine and one of my greatest rivals at the time. Daniel was an awesome guest, really. We had a lot of fun on the talk. Conversations were great. We're discussing some of our memories competing against each other, his motivations and purpose in life, and also overcoming the pressures of performing at an elite Formula One level. So I really hope you're going to enjoy this one. Here we go. All right. Hi, Daniel. Thank you very much for taking the time.
No worries.
And thank you very much for making my dear assistant Alina probably the best moment of her month or something. She'll remember that forever. So thanks
for
that.
Yeah, no worries. I actually... That was emotional. It was quite a hug. She really embraced me.
You felt the love there, yeah?
Yeah, it's quite a warm soul.
Yeah, well, you tend to have that impact on the women around the world, huh? I guess, as you know. I would love to start first, like, with going back to childhood, because I think there's so many, like, great stories there, and you have one of the you've had one of the more challenging paths also, because coming all the way from Perth to the world epicenter of racing is a hell of a long way. Do you remember that one moment where, like, the dream clicked and you said, okay, I want to be a Formula One racing driver? Is there that one moment?
Probably not, to be honest. Like, I loved racing. I mean, I love cars. I love motorsports growing up. And so my childhood consisted of, weekends, some weekends spent at racetracks because my dad was racing. Not to put him down, but just a local kind of series. It was just a hobby for him at that point.
So he was rubbish.
So, well, I actually, till this day, he can still heel and toe 10 times better than me. There's probably more motorsport in his DNA, actually. But, I guess he never had really the opportunity to pursue it any further. But yeah, so I was growing up at the racetrack. So I was very familiar with the noise, the smell of race cars from a young age. And then, you know, when I was at home, I was scrolling through TV channels trying to find any form of motorsport I could. So it was definitely in me from a young age. But I mean, I hear some people say, you know, when I was 5 years old, I knew I was going to be an F1 driver or something. And I do struggle to believe that, because who knows what you want, you know, at such a young age. But yeah, as I started going through high school, and kind of understanding I wasn't really passionate about anything other than racing, I think that's when it kind of turned, and then I put a bit more effort into it and figured it could work. But it probably wasn't until, yeah, like 16, 17 years old.
Sounds a bit similar than in my case, that my mom is also convinced that I got all my talent from her and not from my dad. So it's probably similar in your case. The talent has come from the mom then. in what you're saying.
No, my dad's good. My dad's good. But yeah, definitely, like, just, I mean, being in mum's arms, you know, as a kid and being at the track and, I don't know, they all contributed. And as you touched on, like, coming across, you know, from Australia across the pond to Europe, that was, I think, not easy as a parent to let your son go and do that. And I did it when I was 17, and actually I was still quite a young 17-year-old. I was quite immature, I guess, and I didn't think I was prepared to do it. So for my parents to kind of put that trust and that support in me, that was huge. So yeah, I certainly owe a lot to them for, I guess, giving me that head start, you know, without pushing me though. They never pushed me to do it.
And arriving in Europe, that was really, do you remember that also as a tough time? Like, so far away from friends, family, mm-hmm. And it's that dream that then kept you going. Is that the way, or?
Absolutely. And I think I was still kind of young and naive enough to know any better. So I was living in an apartment in a small town in Italy with population of probably 1,000 people, average age of probably 97, no internet, no nothing, you know. So so my days consisted of waking up, going to the gym, eating lunch, going to the gym, sleeping.
Oh my goodness.
But I didn't know better. And that was like, I was like, well, every other driver's doing this and every current F1 driver was doing this. So this is what has to be done. And so I didn't really get homesick or feel sorry for myself because in my head, it was just what needed to be done. And the weekends, it was lonely, but the weekends racing kept me satisfied enough that when I was home, I had enough to look forward to.
And may I ask how you found your way to pay your way into that racing? Was it a lot than just yourself hustling and finding that next Helmut Marko to support you? Or what was the way in the early days?
Yeah, that was, so 2007 was the first year I moved to Europe. And so we had enough funding that year, you know, so dad built a business over the course of his life and so that paid for the majority. And then we had some family friends who also had their own businesses who chipped in a bit here and there. So it all helped. But then to do a second year with, you know, a bit more of a budget was going to be tight. So really the objective in 2007 was to do enough to get the eye of Red Bull. You know, there was Red Bull, there was Toyota Young Drivers Program. There was a few. So it was to try and get one of them, but Red Bull was like, as a junior coming up, and seeing like the Red Bull painted cars, like they were the targets. They were the ones to be a part of or to beat. And so that was my target. And then I got an email at the end of 2017 from Red Bull, and they asked if I wanted to do, well, they asked if I wanted to do it. Of course I was going to do it, but they're like junior evaluation test to see if I could be part of the program in 2008. And that's where I met Helmut, and that's where it all started. Yeah.
And that was them coming towards you?
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
That was, so I had, I had no podiums that year, but I had a lot of fourth places, and a lot of the time I was, let's say, splitting some of the Red Bull cars and whatever. And I wasn't necessarily in a top team. So I think they just recognized that. I'm sure there was a bit of, I don't know if there was much else going on in the background, to be honest, but I certainly wasn't doing any hustling. Like I was too young to hustle, but it worked out well. And then the test was pretty intense. Like you get 5 laps to pretty much show what you got. But that pressure for me was like so exciting, and I really felt like it was my real opportunity.
You got to give it to Helmut Marko in terms of finding huge talents. He's really had a great track record over the years of finding really special drivers, hasn't he?
Absolutely. You know, Helmut was, critical in my career and my growth as a driver. Crucial is probably the better word. I signed the contract then and there at the tests. I still had, you know, my gear on and, but you know, he was always very passionate. He cared, and because he cared so much, he was also very, you know, hard sometimes and firm. But anytime I finished a conversation with him on the phone, I knew where I stood and what he expected. So it certainly made me grow up quick, and I respect him a lot for that. And wasn't always nice seeing his phone, seeing his name pop up on your phone.
You sometimes get the chills, yeah?
Like, oh, do I really want to add to it? But you're like, if I don't answer it now, I'm just going to have to do it later. So I was like, all right. And then sometimes you just have to listen and nod and suck it up.
Dear listener, if you're not, of course, some of you won't know, but Helmut Marko is the head of Red Bull Motorsports, and he is the guy who picks the talent and also sort of is the lead consultant or sort of boss even of the Red Bull Formula One team. So what was the worst telephone call that you heard from him? The one where it was the most intense. Can you fill us in? And how you take that as a young driver then? I'll tell you one that I got, for example, my first year in Williams. So Sam Michael, the boss of Williams,
Australian.
My first year, fellow Australian, fellow tough guy. After 4 races, I crashed on the first lap. He calls me after the race. Nico, you were totally useless to the team this weekend. That's it. Oh my goodness. I was a young guy, 20 years, first fourth race in F1. And this guy was, for me, the Helmut Marko, because I had so much respect. You were totally useless.
I still get
the shakes.
They're the worst ones when there's no swear words. Like, so it's
oh, yeah,
not
exactly.
Like,
yeah.
When they're real words, that's when it hurts more.
Yeah.
So the Helmut was it was the start of 2010. So it was my first season in World Series by Renault at that time. And I was coming into the season, you know, young driver, hot and one of the favorites. And about a few or 2 weeks before the first test, and we only had two tests, so it was limited. But basically, I had a crash on my mountain bike and fractured my wrist. And I knew I couldn't do the first test. Like, I could hardly move my hand, but I still flew to Jerez in Spain to try and show that I was going to at least try. And I did the outlap, and I came straight back to the pits. And I just said, sorry, guys, I can't. So then my phone rings, helmet.
Oh, geez.
What happened? I was like, I really tried. I couldn't. I was like, I'm so sorry, but I'll you know, I'll let it heal, and don't worry, I'll be ready for the first race.
And did you think maybe that was it? That was it for me and my Red Bull?
I knew it was going to be tough, because then the next words were, it was a lot of silence, and then it still kissed me. You're an idiot. And hung up.
That's it?
Yeah.
Holy moly.
And I know, it's like, as I said, he could have gone and said, you're an F in this and an F in that. My goodness. That would have been easier, but just like, you're an idiot, and hung up. I was just like, oh. So yeah, so I did the next test in Magny-Cours. It was probably about 10 days later. And I remember all the hairpins, because I couldn't get enough rotation with my wrist. I was just like one hand. But that's where I started, and that was, it all just got better then. But I got pole in the first race, actually.
Awesome. So that's the way to come back, huh?
But yeah, there was a few calls.
That's the way to fight back.
A few calls from Helmut.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
So one-handed Kubica, no problem, huh? Doable.
Yeah. You get
not that he one-hands it, but he has less of the second hand, so.
It's like what he's doing also is impressive, and I think it's cool to see him back. It's a shame to see the situation the team's in.
Yeah, of course.
I think for any F1 fan to see a team like Williams be struggling like that, it's obviously not cool, but to see him back on the grid and his whole story is amazing. But yeah, it's when you need more lock, that's where it's going to struggle. But he's all right. He's been through a lot, so he's driving an F1's easy for him now.
No, big respect for him. I want to come back a little bit. You have the coolest nickname, I find, like for any sports personality or whatever, because it just fits so well. The Honey Badger.
Yeah.
And I just want to go through where it happened, because I, of course, had to study quite a lot about your life this morning and yesterday. And so there was this really nice story of you've not always been the Honey Badger, because when you were starting out in karting, I don't know, 13 years old or whatever, you were really shy and insecure and not going for those opportunities and sort of holding back and not wanting to cause a mess. Is that a bit the truth?
Yeah, definitely. Like I was never really a fan of conflict, you know, and I was so a lot of the time racing, I was fast enough, but you know, I'd get close to the guy in the lead or whatever, and I wouldn't always pull the trigger, and I was hesitant. So for a lot of years, I was like just had the speed, but didn't have that tenacity, or it looked like I just didn't want it bad enough. And at that age, yeah, I probably thought that was true. I didn't really know. But then I think over the years, and I had a few driver coaches in karting, and they hardened me up a little. And, you know, by the kind of the end of my karting career, I was, you know, I got that kind of killer instinct in me. And I think you always have it in you, but you just, yeah. I sometimes just needed someone to reinforce it, you know, that I was strong enough, basically. So yeah, I got it in karting, and eventually I entered that phase of my career being, I thought, quite badass on the track. But then like fast forwarding a bit to then when I got to F1, it felt like I was starting back at square one, you know, in karting, and the cars are fast. These drivers have been here a lot longer than me. They're, you know, older and more experienced, and like I was just a bit intimidated probably and overwhelmed by the whole environment. So I had to kind of start from scratch again, but I knew it was in me, because again, I'd proved it in the karting, but it just took time. So the Honey Badger name, it came from, so my trainer at the time, Stu, he was, I think he'd seen one of the documentaries on it, or he'd seen something on YouTube, and he came up, he showed me the video, and he goes, mate, this is you. He's like, I know this is you, because you're nice and you seem friendly and you are cuddly and cute and whatever. But he's like, you have this, you know, killer instinct in you, and you can make this switch. And I think this fits you perfectly. And it's up to you now to, you know, run with it and show everyone that you can be this character. So I made a point when I got to Red Bull in 2014, I was like, this is my big opportunity. I'll be racing at the front. I can't be pushed around, because if I get pushed around from the first race, it's going to continue like that. So that was it. And I felt that's when I really adopted the Honey Badger. And that's when I felt it flourished, and a lot of big overtakes. And I went from the nice guy to being like the quite aggressive racer, but not aggressive, just strong and determined and had a lot of conviction. Yeah.
That's a nice. So just to fill in one more time for the Honey Badger. The Honey Badger is a complete nutcase, by the way.
Yeah.
Because he's, as you said, cute and cuddly, but he will attack pythons and tigers.
Yes.
And they will be scared of him.
Yes.
So this guy is proper, like, he's the most fearless animal in the animal kingdom.
Yes.
So I think it's really, it's such a cool animal and such a cool comparison. But also just one more time, coming a little bit back, in the stories of big successful people, there's always these moments of guides coming in and giving this small twist, and helping to give this huge progress. And I think in your path to becoming a Honey Badger, which I think is so cool, because to improve as a human being is really difficult, and to adapt your approach is really difficult. So from being like someone who holds back and is scared of conflict, to the complete opposite, to really being always courageous and going right into the conflict and the challenge, is a big transition. I think that's really, really inspiring even for me and for everybody who's listening. And maybe the two guides was one, which I read, the day where you really, like, you were so fast and you just lost or held back in practice, because you just had so much respect for the guys in front who were actually slower, but you didn't want to create conflict and pass them. And then on the way home, your dad seems to have quite a strong character as well. Yeah. And seems to expect his son to push in life, I guess. I don't know if that's correct. And he showed you his extreme disappointment at why you wouldn't just hit it and go for it. Is that right? And was that also a little bit of a turning moment for you?
That day was, I never talked about it much, but yeah, you just described it. I was in practice. So he'd taken a day off work, and, you know, these were still in the days where he's trying to build his business and he's working 6-7 days a week. So any time he took off to take me karting was, a sacrifice, I guess, for him. So I just basically sat behind these two guys fighting in practice, and I just wasn't there. You know, I was just there to be there. And I could tell as soon as I got out of the kart, his look, I was like, he's pissed. So we put the cart, and
I know a thing or two about critical looks on parents.
it's when they don't, when they say little, that's what hurts the most, you know. If he went and flipped it, I'd be like, all right. But the silent treatment is always the worst from anyone that you respect or love. So so there was another practice later that day, but as soon as we got back to the trailer, he put the cart straight in the trailer, and I knew. I was like, oh. And we drove home, nothing, no words, no nothing. And I remember calling one of my friends that night, and I said, look, I practiced today. I was just not really there. And I think I'm done. Like, I don't expect to ever drive again. Like, I think my dad will, he's not going to let me ever race again. So I thought my day was, my career, so to speak, was done. And I would have been.
That's hard though.
Yeah, I was probably 11 at that time. So you know what though? I look back and like my dad is, he's firm, but he's not, I wouldn't consider him, you know, too hard or too pushy. He always gave me every opportunity to go and do it myself. But I guess if he felt like I wasn't applying myself, he would just remind me. But that was an interesting one. So, but again, I knew what was expected, and a bit like with Helmut, you know, you knew once you finished that conversation, what was required to move forward.
But now today you're thankful for that firmness from your dad, no? Because he's helped make you into who you are today in that way, right? And where you are today.
Absolutely. And you know, I look at even just things that I do now, and whether it's on track or off track. And I guess you just get to an age where you finally appreciate your parents and what they've done for you and the way they brought you up. You know, at times I was like, I thought they were so strict and not letting me sleep at a friend's house or something, but there's reasons for everything, and now I'm so grateful for my upbringing. And you know, I think they had a great balance with allowing me to do my own thing but still keeping a bit of a leash on me and keeping me in line. I'm not a parent, but I could only imagine. I mean, maybe you can explain, but I guess finding that balance with kids and giving them enough freedom to, for them not to hate you, but also letting them know that there's still guidelines and yeah, I don't know, rules to follow. Tough.
Oh, very tough. It's the toughest job in the world.
Yeah.
You will get to know it one day.
Yeah.
One more moment of becoming a honey badger. You're on the grid. You're second. There's the other guy who's the probably the big guy who's the favorite to win.
Yeah.
And your coach, not your dad this time, but a coach that came into your life, another guide, like gave you a bit of a push to go into a really big moment of discomfort. But again, you learned a lot. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that was with Michael. When was that? Probably, yeah, it would have been maybe 14 or something. And basically we're on the grid and, you know, we were like fierce rivals through the whole championship and competition. And we knew that we didn't really like each other because we were rivals, but we're there and I'm obviously young and whatever, naive. And he goes, go up and wish him good luck. And I kind of laughed. I was like, what are you talking about? Shut up. No, like, go do it. He goes, he's not expecting it. It's just before the race. He's trying to focus and get in his rhythm, whatever. It's like, you will completely break him. If you go up, shake his hand and wish him good luck, he'll be lost. He won't know what to do. And I did it. And I could tell straight away when I did it. I mean, it was awkward for me, but it was more awkward for him. And I was just like, I get it. I see what he just got me to do. And it was great. And that was like just little things along the way. Like, I think they're so fun. Like these little mind games. But that was one that definitely stood out for me.
And the guy, did he look like he saw a ghost in that moment then?
Yeah. So I like, not to exaggerate, but I do remember his handshake. It was like a bit limp and it was just, he was just completely caught off guard completely. And it messed with him. So yeah. I like it. That part of that, like, psychology behind any sport, I really enjoy.
Learning to play the mind games there. Huh?
trying. You would have had a few, I'm sure.
Oh my goodness. I had Michael Schumacher as my teammate. So this guy, 3 years, Mr. Mind Games, the absolute master. And he doesn't even have to think about it. It just comes natural to him. It's just the way he is. So
the way he operates.
That was a big, big learning curve, yeah.
I guess you took a lot from that.
Yeah, huge. No, huge. Just the warrior mentality, really. The warrior mentality that Michael had is just phenomenal. And living and breathing it every single day. And okay, sometimes too extreme, but always trying to get into my head from the morning till the evening, just trying to get into my head.
Yeah.
And just trying to ruin my self-confidence.
Did you always know, or it only clicked after, like, that's what he was doing? Or when he approached you, for example, you knew straight away what he was doing?
No, I'm quite aware. I'm a very self-aware person and aware of moments. I also learned that along the years. So I would notice, but even if you notice, nonetheless, it still hits you hard. And I mean, there's so many examples. One example, Monaco qualifying.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one toilet in the garage, as you know. I don't know, in Red Bull, but in Mercedes, there's only one toilet in the garage.
I don't even know if we got one.
And so he's in the toilet and I go down and it's 10 minutes before. And I know that, okay, I have my 2 minute session now for the last pee and then jump in the car and go qualifying. And so I knock on the door because the door is locked. And I'm like, Nico here, please let me in. Because usually it's the mechanics who will then, of course, know that in this moment, I have to be the priority.
Yep.
No answer, nothing. So I'm like knocking, no answer, nothing, locked. But I can hear that someone's in there. So here was Michael in the toilet, leaning against the wall, looking at his watch. And he knew that if as long as he made it out with 3 minutes to go, he could still just about jump in the car, put the seatbelts and go before losing actual time and ruining the whole team strategy of qualifying. So he's in there looking at his watch, just like chilling out, counting down. And I'm outside full panic
Ruthless.
Mode. I'm in full panic mode because I need to. I can't go in qualifying with a full bladder.
It will sucks.
Ruin my. It absolutely sucks like anything.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no options for me. So full panic, and so I went for the oil bucket option in the corner.
Did you really? Yes.
It was not even a bucket. It was like this plate or whatever. I don't know. There was no option. And mechanics running, working around, and I'm just there. And you know. And even though, so I managed to do what I needed to do, but mm-hmm. the panic, had such an impact on my qualifying. And so whilst I'm with my oil bucket, the door opens, Michael chills out, walks out. As soon as he leaves from the corner, he starts walking faster because he knows it's like 2 seconds to go to a qualifying. And these games all day long. And for example, also one of his main missions was never to show that I existed in his life. Like he would never in any meetings, never ever ask, oh, what was done on Nico's car? Or, hey, Nico, what do you think there? But really? Not once in 3 years. Like I did not exist. So he wouldn't show me at all that I even play a tiny role in his mind at any time. It was so warrior extreme. But you know, nothing against that. It's a great sports approach. And he never exaggerated. It was always the fine line. Never like unfair or evil or things like that. Always the fine psychological line. But and every day, you know, it's like, so I learned a lot.
As you say, that obviously it takes something away from you, but also that requires a lot of energy, I think, to constantly be on that, be one step ahead and play those games, I guess. I mean, it probably does come fairly natural to some people, but I think it has to take something away from them, even though they still might be getting the upper hand, like to constantly think about, oh, what can I do? And I'll make sure I don't mention his name because I don't want him to exist. And so, interesting. Well, that's cool.
With Michael, I think it really came so naturally.
Okay.
He lived and breathed it. With me, I'm the opposite of that. So I had to learn it. I had to learn it, especially with Lewis and in the team, because you have to stand up and think about those things, mm-hmm. and fight against those things and into those things. Otherwise, there's no chance. So I really had to also change quite a lot. And that was tough because I always had to think about it. It would never come naturally. Always think, okay, I have to do this now, even if it's hell discomfort.
Yeah,
I have to do it because I know that it's going to put him some self-doubt. And as you know, that's part of the part of the game, but for me it's really really not so natural. I want to go into some of your best moments of F1 so far, the most beautiful, the reasons for doing the sport, because it's just so amazing. What would the one stand out?
I mean, the it's the obvious one, but considering you're in the room, I have you to thank for.
No, not that one. Not that one, come on.
Was that later in the chat? Well, you wanted me to bring it up, didn't you?
No. That one, yeah.
I mean, look, that was
painful for me.
Yeah. But from what I understand, you did very well to get through. I mean, you second. You still got second. So, so we're talking about June the 8th, 2014.
You remember
Montreal.
The date? How come?
Yeah. First ever win. And the race was crazy. So, it was nice to... I think it's always nice, obviously, winning's winning, but to win a race that's eventful and that does get remembered, that's also quite cool. And I remember I was kind of, fourth, fifth through the race, and I think Perez was in third doing well. But all of a sudden, I just remember seeing, and I knew you guys were so fast, you and Lewis, and all of a sudden I saw you guys, like, coming, exiting a corner, and I was like, was that a Mercedes? And then I see two and I'm like, what the hell? And then my engineers, like, they got problems. Like, come on, push. And if you can get Perez, you know, you might actually have a shot at winning this thing. But it just happened so quickly. And I was like, holy crap. Like, all of a sudden, like, I was just like, maybe a podium. And I was like, a win could be on today. And then, I won't go into how it all happened, but that was just a crazy race and crazy feeling. And passing a Mercedes down a straight, that was pretty rare, far and few between. So doing that was pretty unique. And actually, I remember, so I passed you down the DRS straight before the last chicane with about two or three laps to go. And I think because I had such a run and the DRS was on, I braked quite late into the chicane. And I remember literally losing the rear into the chicane. And I was like, oh my gosh. Could you imagine if I put it in the wall going for the lead? But, So the moments that followed, so I hit the lead and all I remember was I literally told myself, I was like, please hands and feet still work. Like I was worried in a way that I would forget upshifting and I like my hands would just freeze. And I was just like, come on, like I believed I could do it, but it was a weird feeling. I was like, I had a fear that maybe I would just completely disintegrate under the pressure of about to winning my first ever race.
But that was two opposites now, because you said you believed you could do it, but you had the fear that you would disintegrate because it's such an extreme situation. But which one then?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, as a driver, I always believed and I believed I belonged there, and that season was going well. So I believed that it was all, I was good to go, but because it was unfamiliar, it was the first time I'd ever led a race, I was like, holy shit, just make sure things still work. So it was like, I guess, in a way, like a split second of fear being like, this is foreign to me. And I was like, I believe I'm good for it, but you just don't know till you're in that position. But I remember getting through turn one and two, everything was cool. I was like, all right, just stay calm and then get it done. But I think the cool thing about that day, probably more than anything, is, and I'd like to hear your thoughts, the first win, because it's something you do dream of as a kid, even if you don't believe it, you know, till later in your career, but it is a dream since a kid. I was worried it would just be a big blur and I wouldn't remember anything, but I do remember so much of it quite vividly, and standing on the podium, that was something, in a way, it's like I'd kind of visualized before, and everything just felt so amazing and so real. So I was just really stoked that it wasn't a blur and I could really enjoy the moment, and I still remember the moment. But your first win, how was that? A blur or somewhere
my,
in the middle?
My first win was 2012, then China. Mm-hmm. And it had been such a long time. It was 111 races. So it was like forever. And I
that would have been a GP2, your win before.
Oh,
what
yeah,
you say? It's
yeah,
been
yeah,
a long GP2.
Time. Yeah, GP2 2005.
Or since your first F1
2005
race.
2005, and was the last win, which was in GP2. So I never won F1 until 2012, which was like 6 years and 111 okay. races into my career. And again, we had a terrible car that year, so there was no chance. And I didn't believe, I probably didn't even believe I'd ever win a race at that point, because I'm not the guy who has that huge self-belief. Never did have. And it's just amazing. So powerful. And so it's just the most extreme emotions to win in sports, and then to share it with your friends, family, the millions watching. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'll miss now forever, because you'll never get that again in the rest of the life. That extreme, exhilarating, excess of powerful emotions. I don't think it happens again. It's much slower in the rest of the life.
Yeah. I'm kind of scared about that. Like, I don't know, living such a high.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, trying to fulfill that high for the rest of your life. That's, I don't want to say I'm scared, but yeah, I'm curious to know what it is that's going to find that, or something close to that. But
yeah.
Is that something that you said you're missing, but do you think you will find it through another avenue, or are you going to take up skydiving or something to get that adrenaline? I don't know.
No, so damn, I don't think it's ever going to be there again. The feelings of winning that first race, or winning Monaco, and you've done all those as well, or winning championship, I don't think ever again. The party afterwards with friends, it's just unbelievable. Memories and so lucky. We're so lucky in sports to be able to experience those moments. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's possible again, because even you would say, like, okay, wedding is a big one as well.
Yeah.
So you have that one to look forward to. Getting kids, not so much, because it's so crazy intense. So that takes away a lot of the
enjoyment.
Pleasure, enjoyment in that moment. It's not just that pure thrill. There's so much relief in that moment. After the birth, especially if you have a difficult birth. So, and then there's nothing else after that. I mean, in jobs, no way you're going to have that thrill. It doesn't matter. I just got a huge deal yesterday, actually. But it's months in the making, and suddenly I get an email where it says, okay, we'll do
Congrats.
It. Well, great. Thank you very much.
I know. Yeah.
But there's no way. I mean, there's going to be any thrill. So that's a pity, but that's the way it is. And just got to look back and say, hey, that was just so lucky and just so amazing. And always keep the book there in the next to you where those memories are kept. So you can from time to time look back at those pictures. And that is the challenge for all of us after sports, because it's just so damn extreme. Mm-hmm. And then after sports, it's gone and it goes away. And to get used to that new life where that's not there anymore, it's a challenge for all of us, yeah, which we need to go through. But fine, it's the way it is. Just takes a bit of time.
It's a good perspective, though, when you say, like, at least you look back on it with, it was a privilege, you know, and it was amazing to have at least have had an opportunity to live that life and to do it. So And it's never going to last forever. But yeah, if you look back with it on that positive take, as opposed to the negative of, oh, I'm never going to get that again, then I think that's half your battle.
Yeah. The never going to get that again remains though.
Okay. Monaco 2016. Oh. No, what the hell? Oh, damn. So this is another tough moment. Monaco 2016.
Yeah.
You got, I wouldn't,
No.
18 is the one you smile about. 16, you're not smiling about.
Yeah, exactly.
16.
I said, yeah, I'm smiling now. I wasn't there.
Okay. So Barcelona, I don't know if I'm allowed to use the word shafted, but I think you got a bit shafted by your team there. And the little young kid from the block got benefited with strategy. So Verstappen got his first win. And then you go to Monaco and you're leading the race. Easy win. Easy win. And then you get robbed by bad luck or whatever, because the team messes up the pit stop.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with a situation like that? Two such extreme races, setbacks, horrible. I mean, it's like pure darkness, isn't it? How do you deal with that in those moments?
I think having him back to back, that was tough. I'd never really had that, gone through that experience before. And we went winless in 2015. So, you know, 2016 would come in, Barcelona, we're in that position thanks to you guys. We were leading the whole race really from lap one after that safety car. And
I was 2 seconds a lap slower than you, by the way.
You were?
I was right behind you.
In Barcelona?
Oh, sorry.
Oh.
Wrong race.
Oh, sorry. No, forget Monaco.
No. Barcelona, I cleared the way for you.
So Barcelona happened and I was obviously massively upset because I felt a win was lost through strategy. So I came into Monaco with a bit of a chip on my shoulder, I guess. And yeah, the weekend was dominant pole, my first ever pole in F1. So that was a massive moment. And I think to do it in Monaco is unique. And then the race, it started wet, and any street circuit in the wet it normally spells chaos. Like, especially if you're on pole and you got pole in the dry, you don't want to wake up to rain on Sunday morning. It's the truth. You just don't want it. So already Sunday morning, I was like, all right, we got a few curveballs, but I'm good. I'll be right.
So you try and see the positives.
Yeah. And I was like, you know, it's just going to test me, but I'll figure it out. And, so through the wet, the first phase of the race, I was actually doing quite well, holding my own. And then, pit stop, tires weren't ready. And that's when Lewis got the lead and won the race. So, it was the first time in my whole career, actually, that I'd left before the debrief.
Oh, really?
So like after media, I went straight back home. And I didn't feel like seeing or speaking to anyone. And I knew it wasn't going to be productive as well. Like for me to go and throw a table or something isn't useful. And
have you done that?
I haven't. Well, I don't think so. No, I haven't. But also I wasn't interested in the sympathy. I knew people were going to come up and say, I'm so sorry, but I just needed to be on my own. So, that was tough. I don't know. It hurt because I think, and with racing, unfortunately, there's so many variables, you know, and as a driver, you can prepare as well as you can. And there's races where I'm sure you felt it. You rock up to a race weekend knowing you are in the best condition of your life, and you might have a terrible weekend for reasons unknown or for things out of your control. And that's where it's hard, because it's like, yeah, what do I have to do to kind of get this thing going? But fortunately, I'm positive. And once I let the emotion kind of pass, I looked back on the weekend and I was like, it was a massively positive weekend. I was the fastest. I got my first pole. So bring the positives with me to Montreal and leave the negatives for the team to kind of sort out.
And that's just with time and because naturally you tend to be a positive person. Yeah. So you're able to focus on those positives.
Yeah.
Time always. Yeah. That's a big strength, huh? I guess
time definitely heals most things. And I had family with me. I had some friends here for that weekend and they help. You know, I think sometimes being on your own is nice and sometimes you need your own space. But in terms of getting picked up, I think having close friends helps, you know. And I had some friends from Perth who were here that weekend and yeah, they helped me rally through it. So, and also I've always had that kind of mindset that it could be worse. And even a bad day for me that day was a second place in Monaco. you know, like one of the worst days of my life was a second place in Monaco. So I also don't want to, I never want to seem like ungrateful or spoiled. You know, I know the competitor in me will show the frustration, but I think the human in me will always appreciate the position I'm in and try and see that perspective.
So it did get worse. Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan.
You're pushing me. I won't break.
No, but it's important to go into these
absolutely
as well as the really beautiful moments, to also go into the tough moments, because also for everybody who's listening, the tough moments in sport, in your words actually, you also said racing at the top is absolutely brutal, and it's especially because of those tough moments as well.
Yeah.
So Azerbaijan, now you're racing Max, and you're at fault primarily. I'm not sure if that was the conclusion, but that's my opinion anyways, and take him out. And so it's, I know all about.
Oh, your opinion is I took him out.
Sorry?
Your opinion is I took him out.
My opinion is that you were more at fault. Is that not, was that not the conclusion?
This podcast is finished.
No, but anyway, this was my opinion that more percentage on your side,
It's all good.
And not important, long time ago. But but okay, so both cars go out. Actually, maybe on this one, I mean, for you, it's going to be super tough again. Personally, I think similar to Monaco. Did you feel also letting down your team in that moment, being such a tough thing to cope with?
Yeah, it was tough because I felt the whole race, I didn't feel the whole race had been managed well. You know, like Max and I were battling, and as far as teammates go, we're battling too hard. And I was surprised that the team didn't kind of put a stop to it. You know, I felt like I was giving enough room, but a lot of the time, you know, he was kind of coming up into me and banging wheels and that. And I'm all like, I like tough racing and that, it's fun and it's cool and it keeps you going. But I felt like at times, again, cause we were teammates, I was like, why isn't the team addressing this? And I also, maybe it's something I should have done different, but I've never been one to come on the radio and complain too much and be like, oh, he hit me. Like, what's he doing? And cause I'm a racer and I respect the tough racing, but I felt like the team should have addressed it. So then they pitted me first. So I finally got past him. Then they pitted me first, but it was like one of the only tracks in the year where pitting first is not stronger. You know, the overcut works, so staying out longer. You know, because the tires are so slow to warm up on such a smooth surface. So they pit me first and I was kind of confused. And then, so naturally he pits after, comes out back in front of me.
Sucks.
And I'm like, guys, I'm like, we're going to have the same scenario again. So I might have said like, is he going to let me pass or something? Because I was leading before the pit. And
let's just say the truth. You said, get him the hell out of the way now.
Pretty much. And then my engineer, I remember him saying like, no, like, you've got to pass him again. And I was like, you know what? I had no intention, obviously, of crashing, but I was not surprised. So when I went for it, so I went to do like the kind of dummy. So I moved out. I saw him move out. So I went back in. So at that point, there was space. And then he's kind of made that second move in. And I'm like, oh, I was like, that space is now gone. And then there was no way for me to pull out of it. So, I was just angry, I guess, at that initial moment. I really didn't feel sorry for anyone. I just felt anger, how it was kind of all managed, I guess. But then the days that followed, yeah, of course, I felt sorry for the team and it's more the, you know, obviously all the parts we damaged in that crash. You know, I felt sorry for the people that spent hours putting, you know, those parts together and making them perfect. And we've just gone and disintegrated them.
I actually had to pay for my parts.
Did you?
At the time.
We
I guess it didn't take you to that point.
Not the parts. We did a little bit, but it was.
Oh, you had to pay as well?
There was a little like.
Oh, interesting.
Kind of apology gift for everyone.
Okay. That's how the team managed it. Apology gift. And also.
Yeah. And then we addressed the factory together. We addressed the factory. Yeah.
Together. Hand in hand.
Yeah. So. So we went, when was it? It would have been probably like midweek after the race. We were in Milton Keynes and everyone like for their post-race debrief, and Max and I were along for that. And, you know, that actually felt good to kind of address everyone and I guess to apologize for whether I think it was all my fault or his fault or the team's fault. I think as a man and in the position we're in, we have to address it. And I think it's always better speaking to people face to face than over message or over the phone. And that was, yeah, but it just, it, I guess it didn't sit that well with me how it was kind of handled. But that's just what you get when you got two young, well, he's younger, but two young, determined drivers. You know, you get whatever, you get pride, you get egos in the way, and these things can happen. So good times. Well done, Baku. Well done.
Okay, let's go to redemption. Come on. So your greatest race, I guess. Monaco 2018, would you say? The most beautiful and or one of the most beautiful and greatest races.
The outcome, yes, absolutely. The race itself actually sucked. You know, I hated nearly every lap because I had the issue from, I think, lap 28 of about 78. So 50 laps.
Unbelievable.
That's what I thought. And as soon as I felt this loss of power, again, I'd done everything I needed to that weekend and I just put myself in the right position to win. And then I came out of the casino square and I felt something. And I don't know if I necessarily felt the lack of power yet, but I heard that, I knew something was wrong. And then I pulled out of the hairpin, Mirabeau, is it? Whatever. And then I don't know the names of the corners.
Lives.
And I felt a loss of power and I just came on the radio and I told the guys, and it wasn't anger. It was actually just devastation. And I thought when you start losing power, you think it's going to keep dropping until the engine's done. But yeah, I got through a few more laps and I asked the engineer, I said, is it going to get better? He goes, no. And then I was like, oh, so I was like, I got to deal with this now for something 50 odd laps.
Did you manage to pull some positives from that moment again? No, this time, no.
So
not always possible.
No, actually for a few laps, I was, let's say, pretty negative and pretty down. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to keep Seb behind me. I'm like, we're already a bit of a power deficit on the straights.
Horrible moments.
And now we've got 160 horsepower less.
Horrible.
And I was just like, there's no way. And then probably five laps passed and I could see I was actually staying afloat and he was getting bloody close, but I was like, if I get this clean, if I get that corner clean, that exit, I reckon I'll be able to defend. And fortunately, Monaco's tight. So then I started, my confidence came back and I kind of grew confidence through the rest of the race. And I got to a point probably with, in my head, I told myself, if I get to 20 laps to go without still being in the lead, I said, I'm not losing this race. So that was my like mini target. I said, get to 20 laps to go. So then I remember getting to that point. I was like, no one's taking this. And then, yeah.
Wow, amazing how you built yourself up through that.
Yeah, it was a process.
Did you have to change all the brake balances as well? Like brake balance massively forwards? Because I know because I had this in 2014. This is your first race win.
Yeah.
Me, I was in the same situation. Unfortunately, you did better than me because I lost out to you and you actually won it.
In your defense, there was longer straights on Montreal, so you had a bit more time to bleed.
Yeah, but my car was also three times quicker than your Red Bull in 2008.
I'll take it.
Imagine that in Monaco, brake balance probably 5% forwards.
Yeah.
In Monaco.
A lot of lifting and coasting.
Massive lift and coast because you're burning so much more fuel.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. That takes some adapting in this horrible, high pressure, distraught moment. That's impressive.
Yeah, it was, and you know what? At the time, I probably because I had so much going on, I wasn't aware of how much I was needing to manage. And it was only after the race and after that weekend where the team, and I could see like my engineer, he was literally like, he had no, and this is no disrespect to him, but with all the problems we had during that race, he had no belief that we were going to win. So when I saw his face after, I kind of realized that I'd done something pretty great to get it to the line, like to even finish. They're like, we don't even know how you got it home. So I don't want to blow smoke, but just I didn't realize it because you're just so focused and you're in it and you're constantly dealing and adapting lap after lap. But when I saw the emotion on the team, I realized that what we'd done was pretty awesome. I'll say we, I won't say I said what we'd done. That's better.
Your engineer, when he was speaking to you during those first five laps of really tough, did you feel his disappointment as well? Yeah. Like he thought it was the end?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That makes it even more tough though, doesn't it?
Yes.
In that moment, because you just feel his disappointment and he's like, the message is bringing across, this is over.
Yes. And I think that's what he thought as well. So I think you probably agree, like a lot of the time your engineer feeds off you and you feed off your engineer.
Exactly. Massive, massive it's, communication importance there emotionally.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
I agree totally.
And that's so when he, when I said, is the problem going to get fixed or better? And then he said, no, it isn't. And the tone he said, no, it isn't. I knew, I was like, this is done. But then, as I said, once we started doing a few more laps and, you know, I would start to maybe pick up my radio communication, then I could tell his tone of voice was getting a bit more positive. And then by the end, I remember with a few laps to go, I think he said, all right, you got like four laps to go. Like, you're doing awesome. And he gave me like an instruction, and I just said, mate, I got this, buddy. Like, and I just gave him that kind of closure and that I'm good and cool. To leave me the F alone.
Awesome.
Because I want the next few laps by myself.
Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah.
So I actually did a lot of work on this with my engineer, because I'd had the same engineer for 10 of my 11 F1 years, always the same engineer.
Whoa.
Yeah. So my first year and my last year was the same engineer all the way through.
That's
and
pretty special.
I did a lot of work with him on this, because he was also always so real to me. When he was disappointed on the pit wall and had no more hope, he would show it to me immediately on the radio. Mm-hmm. And we did a lot of work together that I was explaining him how important it is for him to, whatever happens, keep fiery and keep positive and keep pushing me and keep optimistic. And he also there changed so much. And that was really powerful, even for my last year in F1 then. He would always keep building me up in like crucial moments.
Yeah.
So that was really, really cool progress. Yeah. So powerful.
And I don't think they realize it until address it. But
well, they often forget that we're human beings in the car.
And it's lonely.
They think we're an extension of their lines on the computer. No, I'm serious.
Yeah,
very often
true.
The engineers who are mathematical geniuses, they think we're just extensions of those lines that they see on their computers, and forget that we actually have emotions in that car, and we're sometimes have fear and worries and self-doubt and all of that. So that's also something that it's important to try and remind them from time to time. You've had those same experiences, though.
Absolutely. It's so true. And that's been a challenge, actually, this year is, you know, so I worked with Simon for all my Red Bull years. So that was, I think, 5 years. And now this year at Renault, I got a new engineer. So getting that's kind of underestimated as well, is how important that relationship is. And not only him being smart enough to engineer the car, but that communication and getting to know each other's language, and again, knowing when to pick each other up and showing confidence and showing fight. So that's been, you know, a process, but it's been really cool. And yeah, it's powerful. You know, your engineer it has to be your best friend.
This is just you having learned to go in and attack into those difficult situations just full on and not be fearful, because you know that that's where you get the most opportunities, the chance to improve, right? That's a bit your new learned approach, right?
Yeah, that was actually, I wanted to touch on it earlier when we discussed the Honey Badger and the reason as well for me, like, putting myself out there and changing my approach with the racing and being aggressive was, there was too many times, you know, throughout my whole career where I would leave the track on a Sunday night feeling sorry for myself and basically leaving with regrets. If only I tried that. If only I did that. You know, the gap was there. I should have done it. Why didn't I try? And I was constantly like going through that, and it felt terrible. And I felt like I wasn't doing it justice, you know, myself or people that were supporting me. So I kind of just made also when I guess adopted the Honey Badger, I kind of made that pact to myself that I would rather try and fail, so try and potentially crash, than not try at all. You know, I can live with myself so much better if I have a go. And I think also the people around me, unless I'm being reckless, you know, they're going to respect me. So, and then it kind of once I started getting it, then, you know, your confidence builds and you have confidence to keep doing it. And it feels good. It feels great. And, you know, I did fail a few times, but it was so much better than just sitting behind someone the whole race and being hesitant to pull the trigger, because you get nothing from that, you know, unless you're in the last race fine for a championship, and that's a different scenario. But it's not, it's so much more fulfilling going for it and leaving it all out there, because I guess why else? I know it doesn't really make sense any other way, really.
Let's go for a Michael Jordan quote. I know he was on your kids' room's wall,
yeah,
and he was a big inspiration to you. And the quote from him is, you miss 100% of the shots that you don't take.
Yeah.
That's exactly. A cool quote.
Really cool.
So come on, everybody. Let's go for it.
Really cool.
Let's take those shots.
Yeah. Right? And I encourage that with anyone in, and that's obviously in a racing term and him in basketball reference, but it can be with anything. And even like my friends, you know, when I see that, you got to be careful, but sometimes I'm just like, I want to say it how it is. And, you know, if some of my friends aren't happy with their life or their job or what they're doing, I'm just like, well, what's the point? Like, why are you still doing this? Like, what are you afraid of? And just go for it, try. And if you fail, who cares? Like some of my friends have talked about maybe leaving Perth and traveling abroad and finding a job and whatever. And I'm like, all right, if you travel and it doesn't work and you don't find a job that works or you love, you got nothing to lose. You're going to have so much experience from the traveling that you won't go home with your tail between your legs. Like you'll be fulfilled in some way or another. And, yeah, I guess it's just important that like we only do get, sorry, I'm going a bit deep, but we do only get like one chance at all this. It's like, for me, it just seems silly not to make the most of it and at least try be something or do something than just exist.
That's an awesome life approach. And I'll give you some credit at this point. Whenever you would appear in my rear view mirrors,
yeah.
It would be the most non-nice feeling because I know I was at the highest risk of anybody else to lose my position now,
yeah,
and to succumb to an attempt at a crazy lunge which usually works for you, so I'll give you credit for that.
Thanks. Budapest 2015, it didn't work for us,
but that was
I was pretty far back.
Yeah.
I hadn't had a podium in a while.
That ended with me in a puncture. But I'll probably take most of the blame myself. But anyway, it ended with me in a puncture and you breaking your front wing a little bit, but you still finished third. So I'll give you credit for that. I'll be honest now, that's the feeling I always had when I saw you behind.
All right,
I was
thanks.
Like, oh no, not him again. Come on, couldn't it be anybody else?
Thanks for your honesty.
But let's go. You had some awesome teammates. Seb Max.
Mm-hmm.
I want to avoid asking you the usual journalist questions because I know that they just suck. But of course, for the listener, that's really interesting. Maybe especially in the way of what can we learn from those guys? What did you pick out from Seb? You destroyed him, if I may say, in my words. and you're the only guy in the world for now to have destroyed him in that way. Leclerc now has a chance. At the moment, it seems. Let's see how it goes. But he could have turned into an upper hand similar to the one you had, maybe. But you really destroyed him. But was there anything anyways that you were able to learn from Seb? I mean, you were really young. You came into the team. What was he doing amazingly? Because he's a four-time world champion at the time.
Yeah, I was excited for that challenge and the on-track challenge, but also to see how he worked off track. And I think a lot of attention to detail. You know, he lives and breathes racing in terms of I felt he didn't have many other hobbies. You know, it was pretty much racing and he was really just absorbed a lot by it. So just time with the engineers and also he had a good way of communicating. I think he was firm, but not disrespectful, you know, so he would tell if something wasn't good enough, he would say, it's not good enough. We can do better. But it was in a way which, yeah, it got the message across and it was, as I said, firm, but he was direct, but still kind, still shook everyone's hand. Like, yeah, there was just, he had a good balance, I guess. And, so yeah, probably just the work ethic, impressive. And with Max, I think, you know, one thing I definitely saw and realize and understand is it definitely helps having a quick teammate. You know, I think there was times where I got more out of myself when I didn't think I could, and he probably could say the same, you know, and I really think that we pushed each other more and more and got that extra 2/10 that sometimes we didn't think was there. So, you know, with Max, one thing, he was just quick out of the box as well, like FP1 first lap, just go. Like there wasn't much of a feeling out process. I think he drives on a lot of probably just instinct and he just goes. So, yeah, there wasn't much of a building up and, you know, a new track, kind of feeling it and getting the tires in. So he's still, I guess, technical, but he's probably got less, I think Seb, much more of a sensitive driver, a lot more sensors in his body to kind of communicate with the car, where Max drives probably more off instinct and raw talent.
That seems a bit like the Michael Schumacher Lewis Hamilton comparison for me. It's very, very similar.
Yeah.
It's Michael Schumacher is very similar to Seb. The details.
Maybe it's a German
team,
thing.
Possibly, actually. Yeah. The team communication, the leadership, you know, really driving everybody in the same direction as a leader as well.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really cool to see with Michael. And Lewis is just similar to what you said about Max. Just much more that unbelievable raw talent and less so of the whole calculated, rational, working ethic, details, things like that. It's there as well, but not to the extent. I guess it's maybe quite similar. So who's quicker, Seb, Max? If you had to pick one on one lap, single lap, straight out of the box.
Yeah, Max.
Max.
Yeah. And that's, look, I won't take anything away from Seb. Like, Seb is not slow by any means. But I would say on raw speed, probably more as well, because Max is still young. And I think if he's quick now, he's probably only going to get quicker, where Seb's been doing it that long. I think you'll always improve as a driver, but there's probably less room to grow for Seb and there's more for Max. So yeah, I'd say that. If Seb's listening, sorry, Seb. You're still a badass. It's all right.
Change is terrifying, you said.
But you still
learned in life that's where you get the most excitement and the most growth for yourself in life. And is that also one of the reasons then why you went for this huge, in your words, one of the biggest life changes ever, and life decisions, no? To go from Red Bull to Renault?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing I've learned over time and in all aspects through my sport, but in general with life, and I think it's important to evolve. I think it's a nice word, because evolve as a person, as an athlete, whatever, to kind of constantly grow and try to push yourself. And I felt, at Red Bull, I guess I didn't feel like I could do much more. You know, it was fairly limited and the window was kind of closing. I was working, you know, with the same people for quite a while now, and we'd been obviously trying to get to that world title, but we kept coming up short. And yeah, I felt like it was probably just a little bit of a, in a way, routine sometimes. And I just felt I needed something else to also switch my mindset and to, in a way, force me to grow and evolve. And that was really a big part of the reason to move and to switch it up. So yeah, it was for sure like scary, because it was a bit of an unknown, of course, but I haven't looked back, and as soon as I made the decision, I felt like it was the right thing, and I knew it wasn't going to be easy, and I know now there's still a lot of work to do, but personally already I feel really fulfilled, and even so far this year I feel the work I'm putting in and my attention to detail, like I'm getting more out of myself, so I can't argue with that.
So would you say maybe that you've learned to the importance of pushing yourself into discomfort and pushing yourself to grow brings you more happiness as well? Is that what you've learned for your life?
Yeah, I think so, you know, and does it mean I'm happy, you know, running around in eighth or something? No, I'll only be completely happy when I'm winning. But that sense of absolutely like fulfillment and leaving a race weekend with, I don't know, just a bit more of a, yeah, because even sometimes like a podium, I mean, podiums are great, but you know, sometimes even on a podium, I'll be like, could I have done more? Could I have done better maybe? And then, I don't know, I guess now, even if it's not a great result on paper, I feel like, wow, okay, I worked really well with the team. We got the car from here to here, still not where we want to be. But yeah, I don't know. It's just, there's something extra now, which I'm finding, which is cool. And hopefully it eventually forms a two-word prize starting with W and then with a C. But I'm trying to be clever. I'm not clever. A world championship.
A two prize.
Yeah.
Let's call winning the world championship a two prize.
Yeah. There you go. But it's been all right. It's been all right.
Do you understand your purpose already in life? Is that still something you're looking for? Or have you understood it at the moment? I mean, it's winning the two prize. Do you already know your bigger purpose in life? Have you figured that out?
It's a good question. I've probably never been asked that direct before. I definitely feel, yeah, I mean, I feel the racing is more than just racing. And I see it now with age that, you know, what I'm doing, yes, it's what I want to do and I've got the target to be world champion, but it's having a ripple effect, you know, throughout other areas of life. And like people are coming up to me, like that's when it feels really quite nice, is someone comes up to me like, oh, you helped me get through this hard time, or, oh, you know, my mum was sick, and seeing your smile on TV and hearing your thing, like that helped us so much through it. And like some crazy things like that, which, yeah. So as far as a purpose, I guess the way maybe I go about things and keep that perspective and that positive side of the way I go about racing or just life, I guess, is having a positive effect on some people. And yeah, I don't know. I don't actively try to like be that person, but it obviously the way I'm doing it is having an effect. So that's nice. Beyond racing, I don't know yet. I don't know. We'll see. But I would love to, as much as I love racing, I would love to find another real passion in life and to find something else to pursue once it's all done. And yeah, I guess find another purpose on a professional level, but not sure yet.
Nice that you're so aware of how inspiring you are, though, in what you're doing with so many people around the world, because that's powerful.
It feels weird even talking about it, but again, I'm at an age now where I can probably understand and acknowledge it, and it is nice. If you can change someone's day, or I don't know, to have that effect. It's weird because I don't feel like I'm anyone different to anyone else, but yeah, it's, I don't know.
Yeah, but you are you're in the 99.9th percentile in human performance. Yeah. With what you're doing and the attitude that and this is what I love about podcasting, that it's really, I'm getting so many comments below of, wow, that's so inspirational, lessons from the guests that I've brought on, and please, if you're watching on YouTube on this occasion, please as well comment below, because it's always nice to hear, and I'm happy to reply as well. And it's really cool. That's, YouTube is such a positive platform as well. And yeah, podcasting, I think. So that's what I love about doing podcasts. And I'm sure, again, with all that you've been talking about, yeah, there's going to be some amazing, amazing inspirations for you who's listening. I'm very sure of that.
Podcasts are great. And I've really got into the last few years, and even this now, like being able just to have a conversation and with no distractions, with no, unfortunately, if you go out to dinner with friends and that, and you try and start having a conversation, then someone brings out their phone, and it's always a bit broken. And I don't know, I think podcasts is great because it encourages just real conversation with just pure FaceTime, no other distraction. And I mean, this is the longest conversation we've ever had in, you know, how many years of traveling. So it's cool. But I'll just quickly ask you a question, if that's cool. What was your... what drew you towards, I guess, having a podcast, and is it just you enjoy the conversation, or you feel you could learn more through other people?
No, that's quite simple. So the purpose of the podcast is, I really wish to extract these life lessons for all of us, for me who's listening to you now, and for everybody who's listening. That's what I really want to achieve, because I find it very inspiring. For example, there's Tony Robbins out there, or Tim Ferriss, which are the greatest podcasters, or one of my favorite actually is The School of Greatness. And by the way, I was reading the book this morning and took a lot of points, which I've asked you today, from that book.
Okay.
From The School of Greatness. One other point, which is going to come in a second, Lewis Howes. And it's so cool. And I love that. And I've taken so much for myself. And this is what I want to try and achieve as well now with my podcast, to give back to everybody who's listening. And because as well, it's a topic that I've worked so much on. So I think I've come to a point where I do have certain understandings for some things, in this whole area of personal development and self-improvement. Cause I had, studied philosophy for 10 years and worked with a psychologist for 10 years. And especially in the last year of winning the world championship so intensely. And so I have a lot of, and there's an ocean of knowledge out there, which we're all not tapping into. Mm-hmm. And I can only encourage to, we were speaking about it in the car, yeah, and you were like, are you sure that's a good idea? Like, isn't that a bit scary to see all that, all that's out there in terms of possible mental improvements or struggles or all the rest of it that you can learn about? And I was like, no, it's unbelievable. Because everything that the two of us will feel on a daily basis has been felt before by a genius in the past, who's been able to write it down in a book in the way that we can understand it very easily. Everything that we experience has already has already been experienced previously in any extreme form or whatever. And so when you then read about it in a way that it's really easy to understand, it sort of, it often just clicks for you. And understanding is powerful, because if you understand why you're jealous, why you're scared, why you're angry, it will help you so much in understanding. It help you to react in a more appropriate way with a bit of time. And it's just extremely powerful, and it has a snowball effect then. So I can only recommend to everybody who's listening. Right. Start with reading the School of Greatness book.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Okay.
Really, really cool. And it's also an ex-sportsman, ex-American football.
What's his name?
Lewis Howes.
Lewis Howes.
Yeah.
All right.
And Lewis, if you're listening, I want to come on your podcast, please, as a guest.
All right.
I would be honored. Okay. One more thing then. Goals. You said you want to be world champion. In a lot of the most famous people, they take the time to write down their goals specifically on a piece of paper and remind themselves of the short-term, long-term goals on a daily basis, keep looking, and it really gives a direction in life. So you're not going all over the place with your head. Have you done that for yourself, or is it just in your head that you've set your goals, and can you take us through them?
So I haven't actually written down that, I guess, set goals. I mean, yeah, in my head, I know what I want to achieve, but yeah, I haven't said by this race or by July, I want to be here and there. It's probably a good thing. And actually, I've just recently started writing a journal or a diary.
Ah, that's super powerful as well.
Insane.
Amazing.
Insane. Like, it is so, I don't know how, it sounds so silly, and not silly, but so simple. But the release, and because you're writing to yourself and you're so honest, and it's just completely transparent, and it's like you're venting and releasing a whole lot of thoughts, emotions, and it's awesome. So that is, maybe that's my step towards then writing down these goals, but that already has been super awesome for me, you know, the past couple months. And yeah, so, and even just to, I mean, I see you've done it, like, even just, it sounds silly, but to handwrite, it feels good. Like, we obviously did it at school. Now it's just so much, you know, typing on your phone or whatever. And to just sit down there and write, it's kind of meditating, and I've enjoyed that a lot. And then so for goals, I'll come back to you on it. But I think, you know, just being general with, let's say, my move to Reno is I want it to work, but I want to feel like I've really had a contribution, you know. And I want to feel like everything I've done has been for the right reasons, and it's motivated the team, it's pushed the team towards being something that I believe they can be, and I believe they believe that as well. So I can't put a position on it this year. It's more than just what position we're going to come. It's having an impact. And as you said a bit about Michael, you know, he had such an influence in the team and bringing them together. And I think it's a real opportunity for me to try and exploit that opportunity and that position and that role. So just have some ownership, some responsibility, and do the damn thing.
But that's an awesome goal to set, because impact is something that is completely in your control, how much impact you have.
Yeah.
And if you set your goal on the result, there's so many things that are just out of your control. So high chance that it'll cause you a lot of pain. But if you are on impact, that's such a cool way to set your goal. And collective impact as a team, and your impact going into the team and team spirit. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really, really awesome approach. Final words of advice to the younger kids or the teenagers listening, please.
I mean, I guess I touched on it a bit before, but I think, you know, the one from my own experience is that I was, first and foremost, you have to enjoy what you're doing. And again, it sounds so simple and it's so basic, but I think sometimes the most basic things are the best and the most obvious. So have fun. I know my best results, you know, in my sport have come through the days that I've been enjoying it and having fun. And, you know, you feel weightless and it brings a level of confidence and desire. And many hurdles will come along the way and things change, but that is so important to really love it. And it has to be, there are some, you know, I guess, pushy parents out there in the world. And unfortunately, sometimes it's their dream and not their kids, but it definitely has to be your dream. And I don't know, I guess I'm not going to go too deep. I'll literally just say it has to be the one thing that you love doing more than anything else. And yeah, I think then it's so much easier to work, put the work in for it if you're enjoying it. You know, it won't feel like work. You know, the hours you're putting in to be better will feel just, that could be fun as well. But yeah, not that deep, not that inspiring, but.
I'll add a few. And so I guess it's really the courage to remain true to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the most important, to try. And it's so hard.
Yes.
It's so, so hard. Yes. I'm miles away from it still myself, although I'm trying. But I think that's the biggest message, I guess. Be courageous.
Yes.
True to yourself.
That's, and now with, you know, it's probably going to be even harder for the youth coming up now with social media, with all these outside pressures, expectations. And you see it all the time. People are trying to be some, it's all right to look up to people 100%, but be you and do your thing that makes you tick and makes you happy, and create your own path, and be bold enough and brave enough to do things your way. But yeah, it's easy to get lost. So that's where I definitely give credit to my family and just having good friends around you. You know, you will make new friends along the way. That's cool and that's fine, but don't forget your day ones, because they're the ones that will always bring you back if you're getting a bit lost out in that crazy world we live in.
Okay, thank you very much. Last thing, my daughter asked me to give you this gift. It's from her car. No, she said this morning. I said I'm going to do a podcast with Daniel, and she's like, daddy, please give him this from me.
You know what, your daughter, she's three and a half,
yeah, but she watches the races with me.
Well, she's very clever, because it's the left mirror, which is exactly course, the one I did
course,
not look in.
Of course.
Perfect. There you go. I still will be able to laugh about it one day. I guess today is the day.
So, dear listener, if you're on audio, I have to fill in the moment a little bit. So I just gave Daniel the rear view mirror on the left-hand side of my daughter's little tiny Mercedes car, because she was concerned that your mirror must have been broken in Azerbaijan recently at the race when you reversed right into the car that was parked behind you.
Yeah. So, guilty.
So smart daughter I have.
She's learnt well from you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks
for listening, and all of us wish you, of course, all the best for the rest of the season, and that you achieve your dreams and goals that you've set out to do.
Thank you kindly. Thanks.